Well, can I take any questions from anyone at all then, please?
The Church and the Pope. And did you read the Church of England working report on that, whereby the Church was at the forefront and was looking for cancellation of the Trident missiles and phasing out of Polaris and missiles and the submarines? I think the same lesson is being preached by the Socialist Party of Great Britain. In what way does looking at it, the bombs and the resistance parties are objects of destruction to humanity? In what way do you find that the preaching of the Church different to the Socialist preaching in this evening?
Let me take your question in a couple of parts. When you talk about some of the programmes which are on television about Christianity, they've had a television programme recently. I'll come on to the Church of England report in a moment, where they held a seminar, which I think was somewhere in Europe, I can't remember where churchmen from all over the world were invited to come for a week, all expenses paid, to deliver philosophical papers on the attitude of God and Christianity towards the bomb. Now, some of them are saying that the nuclear weapons are evil, some are saying all weapons are evil, some are saying it's necessary to have a certain amount of defence. What we would argue is that, as socialists, bombs do not exist to serve the interests of the working class. Therefore, workers have no bombs. They're not our bombs to do away with. We have to do away with the system and therefore do away with the bombs. But the Church is in a much more compromised position because the Church is getting its funding from the state. The Church is largely dependent upon acquiescing to some degree to the needs of the state or else they're in trouble. And I only have to remind you of the recent sermon in, where was it, St. Paul's Cathedral, delivered by Archbishop Runcie of Canterbury, by no means a revolutionary figure, where he actually said, he had the audacity to say in a church that the Falklands War wasn't a very good thing because it's not all that good to go around killing people. And this caused something of an outcry. And there were Tory MPs saying, if this is the way the church is going to carry on, we'll cut off its funds. But of course, the church tends to reflect the ideological divisions within the state. And just as there are certain politicians, Labour politicians in particular, who want to run capitalism without nuclear weapons, so there are certain church figures who want to run capitalism without nuclear weapons. Now, in a peculiar sense, the church holds a principle. I believe they have 10 commandments, and I believe one of them is thou shalt not kill. It's a moral principle. The Socialist Party of Great Britain has a materialist principle. The materialist principle is we do not want to go in for killing people. We think that the age in which humans kill humans has passed. It needn't happen again. The fights over markets, the technological creation of bombs, it's passed. And therefore, when the Church of England Working Party apologetically says, and they don't say do away with all bombs, they don't say do away with armies, they don't say do away with the cause of war, all they say is phase out nuclear weapons. We disagree with that. We don't want to phase out nuclear weapons, we want to get rid of a lot of them. And not only nuclear weapons, but conventional weapons. But not only conventional weapons, but armies. And not only armies, but nations. And not only nations, but the markets which give rise to national boundaries. So we disagree with that. But to put it in a second, in a philosophical sense, they've got a moral outlook. They're talking about good versus bad. Killing is bad. It's not always bad. Humans kill animals in order to eat them. We don't say it's good. We don't say it's bad. What we do say is you can't have steak and kidney pie unless you do it. They say it's bad to kill. It's good on certain occasions to kill in self-defence. We're materialists. We don't have these moral problems. We're not constantly looking up at absolute definitions of right and wrong, good and bad. We say there are needs. Those needs arise out of material circumstances. We'll do what we need to do. Now, socialists have no need for nuclear bombs, because you can't get socialism, as a rather foolish figure called Mao once said, through the barrel of a gun. You can't get socialism through the barrel of a gun. You can only get socialism through the consciousness of human beings. And that consciousness has to involve the rejection of all of the paraphernalia of private property, including the weapons which are used to fight over private property. We don't say that we don't want the support of vicars and Christians and anyone else who wants to do away with nuclear weapons. What we do say is that it's no good praying and hoping and moralising. You've either got to have political action to get rid of it, or it doesn't matter whether you want them, you don't want them, you like them, you hate them, you're going to have them.
Yes.
Can I ask you something? Just refer back to your lecture about the newspaper in the revolution. Did you tell me which newspaper was this?
Remind me of the second. What it was?
You're talking about pillage. Some newspaper in the Republic. I didn't hear the name of the newspaper you're talking about.
Well, I mean, I don't remember referring to it. Can anyone remind me of what it was I said? That
was it the article which Engels wrote?
Oh, sorry, you're talking about that. Oh, right, yeah.
Could you tell me, please?
Yeah, sure. I'll tell you when it was.
And who?
Yeah, sure. I'll let you. The only reason I didn't say it is because I can't speak German and I didn't want to read it. But yeah, it's called Die Neue Zeit.
Oh, I had Zeit.
Sorry, I thought you were referring to a friend of
mine. Yeah, no. Right, that's by, and it was an article by Engels on the history of primitive Christianity, which was written in September 1894. That's what I was referring to.
Not so much a question, but I'm asking for an agreement or a disagreement. Would you not say that if people adhered strictly to Christian principles, that we would have the same sort of society that is envisaged by socialism? Socialists.
Well, I've got to ask you a question. Which Christian principles do you have in mind?
I thought about those. If you stuck, for example, to the Ten Commandments.
Ah, well, now let's stick to the Ten Commandments. Well, first of all, several of the Ten Commandments are neither here nor there. For example, there are certain Ten Commandments. There are certain Ten Commandments. Well, let's talk about the ones we can approve of. Let's try and have the SDP approach and start with an point of consensus. We can say for a start, killing... Well, I can't speak for everyone, but I would say that for the majority of workers, people are in a position where they've got to actually go out and on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, allow themselves to be legally robbed. In fact, many workers who are working for some of the companies which are owned by, for example, the Vatican, like that great European multinational Immobiliare, they are, in fact, having surplus value stolen from them by the very people who say, thou shalt not steal. That's a problem.
If I can interrupt you. Yeah. There is also the principle that those who are rich should give to the poor, mm-hmm. and thus if that was adhered to, then we would have a society where everyone had equal, and everyone had what they needed.
Right. Well, let me answer that. You say, what about it? Those who are rich should give to the poor? Well, socialists have got a reverse proposition. Those who are poor should take from the rich. It's a quicker way of getting the money.
The point is, if those principles were adhered to, then we would have a workable society in which everyone was happy.
I don't accept that, and I'll say why. The reason I don't accept it are two things. First of all, You see, at the moment, capitalism is based on a certain amount of charity. Capitalism couldn't exist without, when workers fall to a certain level, either the state or individual capitalists or the church administering charity. But let me just make the point. I mean, but by all means, come back. Let me just say, it does administer charity. Now, what I want to just say is this. You see, charity exists, but the problem about that is that we don't want a situation where you have poor people at all. We're questioning the existence of rich people and why they're rich. Now, as soon as you say, look, we want the rich to give to the poor, you're saying one of two things. You're either saying that the poor will always be with us and the rich should always give to them, in which case we disagree because we think it's possible to get rid of the poor, or you are saying that the rich somehow should give so much to the poor that the rich are no longer the rich, then the poor are no longer the poor. Now, what I'm saying to you, and I'll ask you to think about it, is you're looking at the thing upside down. Because, of course, where you've got a position where the majority of people are in a condition of poverty and the majority are in the minority is in a position of privilege, it's no good waiting for the people who are privileged to hand on what they've got to the people who are in poverty. It's obviously the majority of people who are impoverished who have the greatest interest to get what the privileged have got. And all of the evidence shows this. I mean, the fact of the matter is, there are not meetings taking place in London tonight where members of the capitalist class, millionaires and aristocrats and whoever else, are sitting around saying, how can we give to the poor? There are plenty of meetings where people are sitting around saying, we're poor, we haven't got enough, we haven't got what we want, how can we get it from those who monopolise it? So what I'm saying is that we're arguing a situation where you do not have rich or poor. But not only that, in an idealistic sense, we're arguing that you should not have the process, which the present system is, where the rich always will become richer and the poor always will become poorer, where you have a constant situation where the rich are allowed to live off of the poor, where the poor are in a constant position of feeding the rich. You get rid of that system, the whole problem ends. And the trouble with the argument which you suggested, the Christian argument in one sense, is that it's morally quite unobjectionable. But in practice, what it leads to is a sort of a grinding on of capitalism, where every time people are damaged by war, earthquakes, starvation, you throw more crumbs at them, you throw more charity, you help them in some way. But of course, there's also a logical point, and I'm not engaging in logic chopping here, but it's a simple point, that if the rich give to the poor, as the Christians would want them to be, then of course they wouldn't be the rich anymore. They would become the poor. And you only have to look at this in practice. If you take the example of any capitalist living in London now, and say to him, give away your wealth to the poor, what's going to be the logical outcome of that? The man who was poor yesterday is then going to be the rich man. He's going to have the wealth, and the poor man is going to be the man who was rich yesterday, and he's going to have to give his wealth back to him. The only alternative, of course, is a kind of an imposed equality, which is, of course, a game. Nothing at all. You can't impose equality. Equality can only grow out of people's desire for it. So we would say, ours is not a moral proposition. We're not saying people should do this. We're saying it's a position based on necessity. We're saying people need to do it. And therefore, morality doesn't come into it in that sense.
So what is your answer to my question? A straight yes or no? Can you do that?
Tell me the question again.
In other words, do you agree that if the Christian principles were adhered to, that society would be as comfortable, if you like, as that envisaged by socialists?
No.
It seems to me, Comrade Jones, that this young man here started wrong. When he says, do we believe that the rich should give to the poor, he didn't ask himself the question. The rich got rich by thieving off the poor in the first place. So if the rich did give to the poor, they'd only be giving back what they've already nicked. How do you get rich? By exploiting people, by living on the surplus value which is engendered through the wages system. So ask yourself a question. Do they have to give back what they've stolen before you talk about the rich giving? They're not giving anything. They take, take, take. That's why I'm angry.
There's one aspect in this answer that Steve gave to our friend here, which is this, that the account that I read, I think it's Matthew, some number or the other, it goes something like this. It doesn't say, give all you have to the poor. What it does say is sell all you have and give to the poor. Now, the corollary to that is, if the Christian act is for all the capitalists to follow suit, who would they be selling to? Because there would be nobody to buy. You get the point?
Yes. Excellent.
And that is in itself a contradiction to that principle.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm just I don't disagree with anything that's been said. I think Christianity, not particularly Christianity, but that's the main religion of that survives in this country, is a barrier to socialism. I think the religious way of looking at the world is a barrier to socialism. But I would also like to say, I hope it doesn't sound terribly SPD. Ish in trying to find things in common, but for example, we socialists in the two world wars found ourselves in a small minority who were opposing the war. And I would say, as someone who was a conscientious objector during, as it happened, the Korean War, that with all my passionately held, and I think forthrightly expressed, disagreements with all manner of Christians that also were standing up there being cross-examined at a conscientious objectors tribunal, I still recognised I had a good deal in common with somebody who didn't want to kill me, or somebody down the road they've never met, or somebody over in Japan or whatever, less likely to met. I still recognised that for all his what I would say were muddled reasons, I had a lot in common with somebody who didn't want to kill for whatever wrong reasons, and all sorts of people who could quote Marx and all sorts of people I happen to regard highly as reasons why they should be bombing people and should be killing people. So looking at it, if you like, on a purely practical level, I do find points in common. And I can tell you, just last week, in my very workplace at lunchtime, there was I could see through my window a sickening thing, the Falkland Victory Parade. Now, just a few yards from my workplace is a church, St Mary Bow, where there was one of these bickers who goes along with that element of church who is critical of that war or certain types of war anyway. I might tell you that on Tuesdays, and it happened to be a Tuesday, they normally have a lunchtime discussion. I haven't worked there very long, so I haven't been to any length, but I knew there'd be something. I was curious to see what on this day they might be doing. Well, they didn't have a discussion this day. They had a little service. But it was a service entitled For Peace and Reconciliation. It certainly, I gather, was discussing with some of the people as they came out. It wasn't in harmony with the war celebration that had just been going on outside. Well, the people I happened to be talking to, husband, I think, for a wife, and he was a Quaker. All sorts of differences, but you know, being surrounded by a ballyhoo of war hysteria, I did feel certain common bonds with people who are saying, you know, we dissociate ourselves from that. But that, unfortunately, though it gives me a common feeling with him in that sense, isn't, I suggest, a solution to the problem of war. It's nice to know that people aren't in favour of killing and bombing. But if they support a whole structure which, irrespective of their own feelings on the subject, results in killing and war, and trains people to think in the terms which enables them to take part in killing, then that is really what is the problem. And much as we had a common feeling of the fact that we neither of us were celebrating this victory, they had joint responsibility, I would say, with the marchers in upholding a system which results in this kind of thing. So there was common feeling in one sense, but serious criticism also, that you can disagree with the results of something, you can still be responsible for it happening. And it's that responsibility we're really focusing on.
Does anyone have any questions they'd like to put specifically to the chairman about the content of tonight's talk?
Well, I'd like just to make a comment on what Comrade Grant has just said, and that is that I can appreciate the approach that he's adopted on this, and I would remind you that the common passage, or the few words in which you always get thrown at you by questioners, did Marx say that religion was the opium of the people? Yes, Marx did say that, but Marx said a hell of a lot more. In the passage, and I don't remember text and verse and all at the present time, but that particular passage on religion is a marvellous piece of analysis appreciating the role that religion has had when Marx describes it as the sigh of the oppressed, and so on and so forth. And Marx deals with this in a very, very brilliant way, but eventually comes down to complete opposition to religion, but gives real reasons for it, whilst appreciating what might be called the moralistic concepts, you know, which one could be in favour of.
Yes.
One more question that this is my mind, please. You refer to Christianity, or early Christianity. You constantly refer to early Christianity as a form of utopian form of communism, things like that. If you look at the preachings of Isaiah and Amos, their teachings or their preaching appear to be based, to be embedded in socialism itself. Why is it that you always refer to Christianity as a form of communism instead of socialism?
Let me clarify one point. As far as socialism is concerned, as far as I'm concerned and this party is concerned, socialism and communism are synonymous terms. In other words, they mean the same thing. Therefore, we don't differentiate between one and the other. When you say about early Christianity being communist, I stress the fact that, in fact, it was a utopian form of communism. It was a communism which was before its time, which didn't have practicality. It was nevertheless communistic in the way it saw the running society. I don't know a lot about what you say about Isaiah. I know something about what you say about the Book of Amos, because I'm one of those people who doesn't believe in attacking the work of the Bible without reading it, and I've done that. And as far as I understand, the Book of Amos actually consists of a rather kind of apocalyptic view of the future. The Book of Amos talks about destruction, impending doom, the threat of collapse in society. And of course, this very much, the thing about the Bible, which confuses a lot of people who don't know the history of it, is that they assume it was all written in one go, that it all actually belongs to one part. It's not. It's a historically produced document. It was created over a number of centuries. Even if you take the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, they were separated by decades, not by years. The writings on the crucifixion and alleged resurrection of Christ are quite contradictory in their stories about this event. And in the 4th century AD, there was a very important conference of bishops called the Conference of Nicaea. And at that conference, the bishops made a decision about what the official Christian faith would be. They tried, in other words, to get their stories consistent, and largely succeeded in having a monolithic Christian outlook. So, I think the thing about, I mean, in a way, you could argue the same thing is about existing Marxism. A lot of people come along and say, well, Marx said this in this book, that in that book, then Engels said that, and the Socialist Party of Great Britain says this. At the end of the day, you've actually got to say, look, what is the social character? Is it correct or is it incorrect in the social circumstances we're in? And the social circumstances we're in, most of what Amos is writing about was the impending destruction of the temple and of the cohesion of Christianity. What the cohesion, rather, of religion. What we're talking about here is nothing to do with gods, nothing to do with change as a result of supernatural intervention. We're talking about the question, can communism, can socialism, can a system based on common ownership and democratic control of the factories and the farms and the mines and the docks and everything else which produces and distributes wealth. Can we get that now? And that's where we differ from the early Christians. We are part of a tradition which the early Christians were a part of. We're part of a tradition which the utopians in France in the last century were a part of. The Anabaptists were part of our tradition. The diggers were part of our tradition. Thomas More, part of our tradition. William Morris, part of our tradition. We don't agree with everything they say, but we can talk, if you like, about a tendency through history for human beings to say, how can we have a better life? What can we do? Where socialism or communism, because the words mean the same thing, differs in its modern scientific form is that we don't wait for it to happen. We're not hoping or praying. We're not trying to build little communities in the middle of a property society. We say we can do it worldwide, practically, politically, consciously. That's where we differ from that tradition. We're part of it, but at the same time, we differentiate ourselves from it in the best and most positive of ways, because we can do something about it.
I had an interesting insight about a year ago to the position of the BBC religious establishment on this question of Christianity and whether it's compatible with socialism, because you may have seen, I don't think it's on at the moment, but they had this series called Choices, which was advertised initially in its pilot series as a chance to have discussions about moral and social issues on Sunday nights on television. I suspected from the start it would be a religious affair, and it turned out to be so. Anyhow, I got the opportunity at one stage where I was due to take part in this programme as one of the invited guests that they had to put in a particular point of view and to have this view dissected by a studio audience. And the view that I was due to go and put was a criticism of Christianity and religion in general for the very reason that it was anti-socialist, that it in fact had been the principles of religion had been a major defence of property society inherently, and specifically Christianity and in relation to capitalism over the last 200 years. And I had a number of phone calls from the person who I was trying to fix this up with. And each phone call that I got, he was slightly less certain. You know, it started off in the morning, he said, right, there's no problem, you'll be here in a week's time. And I told him what I was going to say, and he said, yes, that would be very provocative. You're in fact arguing that Christianity is not only not socialist, but it's anti-socialist. He said, this will be very provocative for our audience, which will include many religious people. And then the next call came, and he said, well, we've got one or two hitches or something. And it turned out in the end, he phoned me about the third or fourth time and said that it was off. On the night, it turned out that in my place, they invited somebody else who was from the church army. He was putting in the opposite view. He was sitting up there arguing that Christianity and socialism are compatible, not the same thing. And he argued this, of course, because to him, socialism was a kind of moral question in a very innocuous and harmless way, that if everybody was good to one another in a Christian way, then that would be socialism.
And he was a member of the Communist
Party. Yeah, incidentally, he was in the Communist Party just to add insult to injury.
Well, about Jesus Christ, I don't know a lot about him, okay? But I read some book, I read some book, I can't remember which, but he's supposed to have two brothers and two sisters. One of his brothers was James, okay? And Jesus got booed out for being a fanatic. I can't remember what book, but I read it somewhere.
If I just made another point on this subject of charity, because this idea about the rich giving to the poor, and there was some mention of charity, has taken on an interesting aspect in recent times, in the last century, with the development of tax law, and that is that it's become quite a tax dodge for a number of capitalists to endow certain institutions, and because it's charitable, it's not taxed, and this can be used as bribes in various other ways to transfer resources and so on, in a way that giving from the rich to the poor has become quite a profitable business. And in fact, in the case of charity not being part of socialism, there was a legal ruling earlier this year in connection with a case involving the Charity Commission, which said that, that charity, in order to have charitable status, a charity by definition must not and cannot challenge the social order, cannot raise social, political or economic objections to the way society is run. And actually said that, which very much underlines this point, that charity is not fundamentally in line with challenging the social order, but simply hatching it up ultimately.
So therefore, presumably charity could be such a thing as a labour party or a
party? No, it's just the point that it can't be a political. No, they had a broad statement that anything which is at all political, social or economic, it can't be a charity. So therefore, by definition, a charity must be something which doesn't question those things.
Any further questions?
Am I right in saying that Cauchy in that book mentions, in relation to the authenticity of Christ, that there were no less than 200 people claiming to be Christ at different times, and all of them, I think, ended up being crucified? I'm not sure.
Well, actually,
they
get it straight. They get it straight, in fact. I mean, Christ is the Greek word for Messiah. So there's nothing very strange about this. It's not somebody's name. Jesus is a very common Jewish name at the time. It's not these days, for obvious reasons.
Already.
The Jewish parent wanted to call your son Jesus, and had trouble with the local rabbi. The thing about it was, it's a very common Jewish name at that time. And Christ is the word for Messiah, so it's just called Jesus the Messiah. There were a lot of Messiahs at this time, but Messiahs tended to take two forms. Either they were simply trying to extract, to live off other people. They were con men of one kind or another. Quite a lot of those existed. Or they were insurrectionists. Sometimes there were freed slaves or escaped slaves who tried to organise insurrections. And many of these called themselves messiahs, which was a defence. Because what you effectively said to these superstitious state authorities is, if you kill me, God will get you. And it was a way, it was one way out of it. But I mean, in fact, you know, people argue that the whole, you know, the myth and the idea of Christ at Calvary with a cross on the top of a hill. In fact, the picture, if you know, they haven't, when they make the film of it, is quite different. In fact, there were a long, long row of crosses with all these men on it, you know, and each one of them, like, you've been done for raping the local senator's wife, you've been done for pretending that you're a messiah, you have as well, and they were all done on the same day, and that is in fact the way it happened. My argument about the authenticity of Christ, and I mean, as I say, there are all sorts of stories, including that he had radical James. I didn't know about that one. I don't know whether he subsequently became leader of the Labour Party. On that one, the thing about this is it's the story of Jesus Christ, the story which children unfortunately have to learn in schools, is just a contradictory one. For example, that's a very simple one aspect of this. Mary and Joseph were who I believe the parents of this mythical or non-mythical character, were meant to be going to pay a tax to the Roman Empire at the time when Christ was born. The fact of the matter was that the area in which they lived at that time wasn't part of the Roman Empire. You know, geographically, it didn't belong to part of the Roman Empire, so they couldn't have been doing that. There are all sorts of other contradictions in which, you know, aren't worth going into. What we do know is that some of it is pure fantasy. And if you read any historical narrative which consists partly of pure fantasy, then it's going to throw suspicion upon the rest of it. And the kind of thing about, you know, Mary being a virgin and hearing that she'd become pregnant and all the rest of it is obviously something which, in the light of recent medical knowledge, it's likely to be something more sinister. You know, I had explained to me by one person once that what had happened was that the you know,
the Holy Ghost.
Mary was doing a bit of quick talking, you know, but we don't know, and it's really not something we need to go into.
Yes. Steve, you regard history as important.
Yes.
Well, in the history of the working classes, Murrow should be prominent. Your declaration of principles, okay, he more or less agreed with all of them, except for that the workers weren't educated enough to rule themselves. Probably an early day socialist, but I've been to a few of these meetings and I feel that the principles you believe in, this guy also did. And when the majority of the story was given a sense of image, okay, and they come out to be a bloodthirsty monster.
Well,
I can't explain myself talking, right? I'm a writer. But what I would like to do to have Steve Coleman read an article which get together this week.
Yeah, well, that's...
cared about the people. I mean, he's into social injustices, okay? Yeah.
Well, on the last point, let me say, I'd have to read whatever paper you produce on this. You obviously know more about Marrow than I do. But what I would say...
Yeah, but I appreciate you... as a historian, I don't want to take part of this part because this is why I went along with Bob, just to see how I felt about the situation.
Well,
and I'd like to write some essays on Murrow, not just one, a series of them, showing how he's. Politics changed over the era, over the years. So, like pre-revolutionaries in monarchies, okay, and various times proposed a dictatorship and things like that. But his main cause to fame really is his title, the friend of the people, okay.
Mm.
And he tried to practice what he preached. I'm not saying he's the saint. He's a pretty boastful character, but. Is sincere in his convictions, and I feel there hasn't been any modern historians, well, perhaps Gottschalk, biography's not too bad, but the rest of them load of rubbish. And many times I come across quotes of Murrow in history books, general history of the revolution, okay, and they distort the actual statements and, you know, articles out of these newspapers. And they make them out. I don't know, obviously I'm very emotional about who I'm into, but it's why I'm into. I can't explain it properly because.
Would you like to?
I could if you could ask me questions about the revolution or on it.
Would you like to comment on that?
Let me just make two or three points. Yeah. Interesting what you have to say. First of all, anything that you can write or produce on that is interesting. Let me say, I've got a total sense of feeling for what you're saying when you say that this particular figure has been misrepresented by historians. I don't know whether you're right or wrong, but let me just make a point. That, I mean, having spent the last 3 years working on research into the history of this party and seeing the extent to which that has been grossly misunderstood and historically misrepresented in a worse way, I've got a lot of sympathy for anyone who tells me that historians don't always write the truth or have big omissions and so on.
So I don't know whether I could call myself a historian because...
Well, I think anyone who studies the past can call himself a historian. But let me just say that I'm interested in that. But let me just make one other point, aside from the point about Murrow, which I think is interesting, which is that when you say he was a friend of the people, I only say one other thing to you, and that's probably been said to you before, and that is, of course, the most important friend of the people are the people themselves. And right. What I'd say to
and
you is
that's,
this.
That was his general idea of the people. He never once, if I suggested that, he might be mentioned himself.
Well, I'd certainly be interested to read or hear more what you have to say on that.
Well, I mean, obviously, I mean, yeah, other people were influenced by Murrow, okay? On the, what's that guy's name in the, what is it? Babu. Conspiracy of the Equal, right? The Ugly Admirers, right? And Marx was influenced, the rest of the world. And every revolutionary movement in France during the 19th century have had, I can't just say a word of revival of people's favourite journals.
Right.
Are there any further questions at all?
Yes, one question I would like. So far as I recall, it was the policy of the German Social Democrats, notwithstanding the fact that Karl Kautsky was one of their luminaries, that religion, as you said, is often said in Labour movement, was a private matter. Now, for the Labour Party to say that is very understandable. I can't think of any major figure in the Labour Party who has mounted the sort of insight and critique on religion that Kautsky did. But bearing in mind Kautsky did that kind of research, it's all the more remarkable that, as far as I know, it was the policy of the German Social Democrats then, and even more so now, that as a movement, as a party, they don't offer a criticism, a party criticism of religion. And it strikes me somewhat odd that, if that position is so, that Kautsky could square it. Then presumably Kautsky, as a Labour politician, was quite good at squaring that sort of thing.
Yeah, well, I can answer it. I'm not going to defend Kautsky particularly. In fact, the German SDP did have a... you're quite right, they regarded religion as a private matter, and anyone could join them. But most of the prominent figures in the German SDP were anti-religious. And in fact, in some of their prominent pronouncements, spoke of socialism as being a non-religious society. For example, in what I consider one of the most significant works of Marxism of all times, Babel's work, The Society of the Future. In that, he has a chapter on religion under socialism. Pretty short chapter, because he didn't think there was going to be any. Although, it's interesting and very important, and a point I want to stress now, that the Marxist movement, the Socialist Party of Great Britain in particular, has never argued that in a socialist society people would not necessarily be religious or wouldn't want to be religious. In a socialist society, we don't argue that every single human being is going to want socialism before it's established or understand it fully. And in a socialist society, if there are people who want to practice religion, no one's going to stop them. Because in a world where there is democratic control and free access to all resources, if somebody wants to take a building and build a church and take a mass and all the other things, they can do it. No one's going to stop them. And I think, in that sense, the tendency of the German Marxists to say, we're anti-religious, but we don't want to impose that on anyone, was strikingly different from, say, the Russian Marxists, I'll use inverted commas there, who, for reasons again which were perfectly historically understandable, looked at the religious prejudice of the people around them and said, we will have nothing at all to do with them, we don't want anything to do with them. But they went further, because Lenin said, we won't even tolerate them. And this was something which happened, and the persecution of religious people in Russia and other state capitalist countries today is something which we as socialists don't stop condemning simply because we don't agree with the things which the religious people believe in. We think that's something which is opposed to the interest of the working class. Interestingly, one of the early demands of the Marxist movement was freedom of speech, freedom of organisation, but also freedom of any view that you want to hold, including religion. And of course, you only have to look at the fact that many people who moved into the early Marxist movement, including Marx himself, through his ancestry at least, were Jewish. And many of those people knew what it was to be persecuted for holding a religious belief. And they were very careful not to be amongst the first to attack people for holding religious beliefs. In Britain, the tradition is rather different. In Britain, in a sense, it's much more clearly defined. In the 19th century, you tended to have a religious, Methodist-based ILP, moral, quasi-socialism. You know, even at one point there was what was called the movement of church socialism, the early Christian socialism, people like William Trevor. And at the same time, there was the movement which we came out of as a party, the Social Democratic Federation, which was rationalist, secularism. One thing the SPGB did, to its credit, was that when it was formed in 1904, it hadn't been going long, before it had debates with, it couldn't get debates with Christians, because they wouldn't debate. But Christians only tend to want to engage in debate when they're losing. When they're doing well, they're not too bothered about debating things. That's understandable. But we, the party, started to get in debates with the secular society. And what the party started to say was, look, the secular society is all very well telling us that there's a contradiction between Matthew 4 and Luke 2. But what about capitalism? What about the system? And it was the secular society who weren't all that interested in that. And as you well know, that man who was such a famous case, the first man to enter Parliament and atheist, Bradlaugh, all of the other views which he held, well, not all of them, that's unfair, but most of the other views he held were completely antithetical to socialist ideas. And you only have to look at the current leader of the Labour Party. I can't say, as a socialist, I'm not a little bit pleased that the Labour Party has got a leader who, when they have their conference every year, is left standing outside the church with Joan Lester because he doesn't want to go in to pray that they have a good conference. In one sense, it shows that he's a one degree above the rest of them, Tony Benn looking up to the sky and hoping that Jesus will inspire him with more ideas. But nevertheless, when it comes to it, Michael Foot might not go along to bless the armies to go to war if he's ever Prime Minister. He'll still be sending them to war in the interest of capitalism. And when it comes to it, we socialists are always making a big propaganda point. Ah, the priests are always there blessing the guns when they go to fight a war. It's because if someone ever turned around to us and said, well, what about if the priests weren't there? Would that be all right? Because what if he said, it doesn't make any difference. It just adds insult to injury while sealing the wound. So when it comes to it, we can't regard religion as a private matter. We couldn't allow somebody to join the Socialist Party and say, I agree with socialism, agree with everything we stand for, but I've got to go off and say the mass now. I've got to go off, but I don't believe in this sort of God, I believe in that sort of God. We couldn't have that. But what we would say is that if somebody wants to join the Socialist Party and recognise that he's got friends or she's got friends and neighbours who've got religious beliefs, that's okay. And in fact, I can think of a particular branch of the party where there are some members, and I've gone up there and spoken several times, and the parents of these members who attend all the meetings, sit in the front row, agree with everything, and as soon as you mention religion, they go and buy a drink down in the bar because they don't like it. They're okay. They help. They're interested. But when the Pope came over from his visit last year, they were rather a bit away from party activity for a while. That's okay. You're going to have that.
Well, it's hard to say so. Bob Dylan wants to, if God didn't exist, he had to be invented.
Yeah.
So, I mean, like, in the 18th century, anyway, a lot of the common people, the peasants, right, were very superstitious. Mm. They needed someone to believe in.
Yeah, well.
I still think that it counts nowadays. I'm not saying I'd go along with the Jesus Christ, but people need something to believe in.
Well,
yeah,
I've been asked to answer this one briefly, and because I'm glad I've been asked to speak brief, because I've got so much to say, it should be brief. Actually, this is a subject of a completely different lecture, and I hope we'll get around to discussing it one day, but there's something in what you say there, when you say people need something to believe in. One of the things which capitalism does tend to do with people, there's a whole school of psychology which has studied this, is it does tend to say to people, You've got to look up to something. You've got to believe in something. You've got to have... But it was, as you would realise, when you say people are superstitious, therefore they need something to believe in, it's not quite like that. What you could have... Because what you're saying is people are superstitious, therefore they are superstitious. People need something to believe in, therefore they believe in something. What we would say is, when people don't understand things, they invent things. The majority of people don't understand socialism. So when you say we're going to have a world without money, without wages, free access to all wealth, they say it's against human nature. When you ask them to bring you the anatomy books and tell you which part of the soul exists and where it is in the anatomy, where this human nature is, they say, oh, well, we don't know, but it's against human nature. What we're saying, in fact, is people can think of 1,001 ways for why something can't happen, but you only need one answer to tell them why it can. And if it's rational, they can't defeat it. It's like the old Russian saying that a fool can ask more questions than a wise man can answer. You can ask as many, 100 religious people, each giving you a different reason why socialism isn't possible. You only need one answer and you can knock all of those down. Because all we need to say is, history and change and history, you can't separate them. They're always going to happen. And therefore, anyone who comes along and says, this can't happen, well, unless they're going to tell us, unless we're advocating that we're going to suspend the law of gravity or turn worms into human beings or something which is against nature, if it's social, it can happen. And we would argue, therefore, that what people need now is not something to believe in, but something to know. Because people only believe when they don't know. The second you start knowing something, belief can be thrown aside.
Right, well, it's not 10:20, this is closing the meeting at this point. I'd like to thank you all very much for coming and hoping to see you again.